Welcome to the second episode of the Substance Use Disorder Best Practices podcast series, produced by Community Health Association of Mountain Plains States, or CHAMPS. I'm your host, Rachel Steinberg, the CHAMPS Substance Use Disorder Program Specialist. In this series, we're highlighting some of the interesting and innovative ways that health centers in Region 8 are addressing substance use disorders. We think the best way to share these ideas is to speak directly with the health center staff who are providing these services and running these programs. Today, I'm thrilled to be talking with Dr. Sharon Mulvihill and Sandy Larson from Riverstone Health in Montana. Thank you both for being here.
Good morning, and thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, we're happy to be here this morning.
So can you talk a little about Riverstone and the community you serve?
Well, Riverstone Health is a federally qualified health center in Billings, Montana. We have a large area that we serve, primarily rural, but we would define our health center as an urban. We're the pretty much the medical hub. Our patients make up many types of payer sources. We feel that we have a very robust program and can serve pharmacy, dental. We also have integrated behavioral health that we're going to talk a little bit more about. And we also have our primary care clinics, which encompass a lot of different programs. So we're happy to talk a little bit more today about the work that we've done in substance use disorders.
Good description, Sandy. I'd just like to add that Riverstone Health, as a federally qualified health center, treats all patients regardless of their ability to pay. So that means for many patients, this is the only place they have to come. And it is a challenge for us to provide all the care they need, but we have a lot of resources and work as a team.
Great. And Dr. Mulvihill, can you tell me a little about your role at Riverstone?
Yes. Riverstone is a teaching health center. So we include a residency program in family medicine. So my time is shared as assistant medical director of the clinic and also a faculty member with the residency program. So I teach, I see patients, and then I supervise residents, both in the clinic and in the hospital.
And Sandy, what about your role?
So I'm a licensed clinical professional counselor and a licensed addiction counselor. And I, like Dr. Mulvihill, have a teaching role with our residency and medical staff on behavioral health issues. I supervise a team of 9 counselors, and we also work towards just providing care, overall care, integrated into the clinic, into our primary care clinic.
So I know that a lot of primary care providers have struggled and continue to struggle to get involved in addressing substance use disorders. Can you tell me a little about how you each got involved in this work?
Yes. I think working at a federally qualified health center for years, both in the clinic and the hospital, and living through what can only be termed the opioid crisis has presented me with questions I didn't know the answers to. And really reaching out to other providers, I saw a lot of different answers being given. You know, mixed opinions, not good science was quoted. And so the patients were left with a variety of recommendations. And so that really empowered and challenged me and called me to go and get additional training. And also, when you see people that get better from a substance use disorder, it's life-changing. It truly saves their life, saves their family, and it's some of the most gratifying work I've actually done in medicine.
So my mission for how we provide care has always been to treat the whole person. And I've always felt that substance use disorders are another disorder that patients need to be treated for in a primary care setting. We often were referring patients out for specialty care, which is still needed, but we felt like we wanted to keep our patients in the care of their primary care doctors or counselors or substance use disorder counselors. And so that became a passion of mine to be able to work together as a collaborative team and keep that patient here in the clinic and refer out for specialty care only when needed so that we could still continue to do a collaborative model and treat patients as a whole person here at our clinic.
So I know Riverstone has a really robust SBIRT process that is screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment. Can you tell me a little about how SBIRT works and how it got started at Riverstone?
So how we got started with our SBIRT process, so really that's, like you said, Rachel, it's a process for to capture those patients that might be struggling or early on in substance use disorder. And so we decided that we would look at how we were doing. We did a little hand audit of charts, looked at our screening that we always have been, we've always been doing that. But we found that we weren't where we wanted to be with actual interventions and trying to do some more prevention work. So our process came about to do standardized screening for all of our patients. And then we have a workflow that incorporates our, even up to our front desk, knowing when to give it, our MAs, our medical providers, and then on-site referral to behavioral health when those are positive, so that we can have a shared decision-making and a workflow that works quite well in a very busy clinic, because each person on the care team has a role, a specific role.
From my standpoint, as a provider, it was just a real challenge to balance all the screening we try to do for patients, and keep the providers satisfied and able to meet the need that the patient came in for. An example would be a patient out of their high blood pressure medicine where we screen them, the SBIRT is positive, and maybe they screen positive for symptoms of depression or anxiety, and the provider can be very challenged and overwhelmed with all the material there is to deal with and setting priorities. So we've worked really hard as a team to allow and teach providers to understand that if patients' mental health is not well controlled, you can't get their blood pressure controlled. It's all integrated. And so it continues to be a challenge, but we really do shared decision-making with the patient about the priority for the day. And many times if the patient is not in crisis, it may be better to refill the blood pressure medicine and have them come back the next week, but we've already identified the issues and sort of got them scheduled to deal with. So that's been my big problem is helping the providers on the follow through for screening.
And I would add to that, one additional barrier was just coordinating and carving out time to do a lot of training and education. I think that's one of the biggest things to do is have a pretty robust training on how to have these difficult conversations, how to use MI. And so before even implementation, we did a lot of education and training with our medical staff and clinic.
Sandy just mentioned MI. I just want to mention for those might not know and love this wonderful term, that's motivational interviewing, which can really help the providers meet the patients where they are and try to nudge them just a little bit more forward towards wellness.
So you said before that poly substance use is the norm in your community, and I know Riverstone is doing some interesting work around medication-assisted treatment for substance use disorders other than opioid use disorder. Could you talk a little about that, especially what makes that kind of treatment different?
Sure, Rachel, and thanks for that question. That's actually a great question because, what's evolving in the nation is a science on addiction disorders. And what it does is, classify substance use disorders into a big box. And so then you kind of, as a provider and as a behavioral health person provider, you look at what is their main drug of abuse and target your therapy on that. In addition, we try to the best of our abilities, identify if the patient has a mental health condition that preceded substance use disorder. And if so, that needs to be treated concurrently. In many cases, patients develop a variety of mental health symptoms after starting with substance use disorder, including anxiety, some people will have thought disorders, et cetera. So when you identify the main substance of abuse, then you look at what works for that substance. And so in many cases, patients have a predominant substance that they would prefer to use. And that's where we mostly target our therapy. And we, about a year ago, began a very robust treatment for alcohol use disorder. And so using our ESPRT screening, we identify patients that are appropriate for medication-assisted treatment and evaluate them and get them started. And this occurs with behavioral health treatment and support, so that there is a robust attempt to help them with all the social stressors and mental health issues and all the parts that are needed for recovery. But years ago, primary care didn't really think about it so much. It was all outsourced. And so now we kind of create this package of services with medication-assisted treatment being part of the package, and we tailor the medication towards the main drug of abuse, but also at the same time, look at what other mental health issues might occur, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, a history of trauma. All these things will make substance use more likely and also inhibit recovery if they're not addressed.
On that note, I feel like with our treatment, our clinic, that's another thing Dr. Mohill mentioned, trauma disorders. We found that a lot of our patients have a history of adverse childhood events. And so we do really try to incorporate a trauma-informed care approach to all of our treatment here at Riverstone. And that is just understood as written into our model.
So can you talk a little bit about how Riverstone funds ESPRT and other substance use disorder related work? I think you receive a HRSA expansion grant, is that right?
We did. So early on in our efforts to, as Dr. Mulvihill and I were like just talking about how we envision this to go, we realized that we really need to set a good foundation. And with that, if you want to do medication-assisted treatment and ESPRT, then you really need a good core group of people. And so we decided to apply for a HRSA expansion grant. And with that money, we wanted to be able to start another full-time addiction counselor in clinic for point of care referrals and a behavioral health care manager for the team to monitor and supplement that care when they're not seeing providers. And the program is sustainable because our fiscal does a really good job credentialing providers and their billable services, and so we work really hard to stay on top of codes and learning, and so really the money is used for startup costs and just working through that sustainability plan. Then in order to keep providing services, we just stay busy and working as a care team in clinic.
I want to add that all the work that we've been able to generate and do related to substance use disorders directly in response to our robust screening with ESPRT. Because if you don't ask, patients won't tell you. And if you don't identify it as a problem, you can't help them. And I tell patients, it's just like diabetes, except it's a little different. It's just another thing. And I try to destigmatize it, but diabetes, we can do a blood test to do the diagnosis. For substance use disorders, you have to ask questions and you have to do it carefully. You have to do it in a systematic way so all patients are screened. We also screen all new pregnant patients again, because if you're drinking a couple beers a week or a day and you're not pregnant, what's just a different equation? When you are pregnant, you're rescreened and now there's an opportunity for education. So the more you screen, the more work you'll have to do. And when clinics and organizations apply for these grants, at first blush, it might seem that you're not going to have enough work to do. And in fact, the more screening you do, the more work you have to do and follow up.
So Sandy, you said before that it's important to implement other services in conjunction with ESPRT and with substance use disorder treatment. And one of those you've mentioned is care coordination services. Why is that, and what should that look like?
Well, we just feel that there's so many components that go along with a recovery plan. It's not just about stopping use and taking medicine or seeing even the on-site counselors, it really is an overall wellness and recovery plan. And so our goal was to put in services in place to support that overall wellness plan, to really incorporate that into patients' lives. And that means their basic needs need to be met. They need to know that they have housing and that they have food and that they have the things they need to just achieve that. And some of our patients are coming to us without even having those basic needs met. So our care management and care coordination services will meet patients whatever their level that they're at. So maybe your need is to go to school, or maybe your need is a higher level. At any level, we can support and help you with your overall wellness recovery plan. And I think that's the key to really having a good program.
And I just want to add that, as patients move along through the recovery process, we help them, get to medical care. So at the beginning, patients' lives in general are somewhat fragmented. They have a very close circle of friends that often are substance use disorder clients as well. They may be estranged from their families. They may be unemployed. They may be living on someone's couch. All of those things really need to change. They need a recovery network that is healthy. They need to address transportation. Many of these patients, they didn't really care if they showed up for things before, and now they've never been on the bus. Or, we'll get them a taxi voucher, or, we teach them how to use Uber, which for many patients is not, it's like $4 or $5. We live in a pretty small community, but we're very north, we're in Montana. So walking to clinic doesn't work in the winter. So, and what patients see over time is this just really gentle caring that we give them in a consistent, respectful way. And that is so powerful, many of these patients who really haven't had that in a long time. And as they move through recovery, we see them miss fewer appointments. And we see them come early and stay late. They're the people that are in the waiting room an hour early talking to the guy that is out there in the waiting room, straightening magazines. And, this becomes part of their life is coming to clinic as they transition through recovery. And then, funny as it may seem, we become less of their life as they move on. So they end up being very dependent on us. Some of them are in and out of here every week. Oh, I just want to check and make sure I had refills. Oh, I do. Okay. How's everything going? But they see this as a safe, kind place. And that can be so heartening for someone that's still struggling with, do I use, do I don't use, or do I go hang out? And then when you see the patient on the other side of recovery, making good life choices. It's amazing that we were part of that.
So you would want to share that show the impact your substance use disorder work has had on the community?
Let's see. I think, one of the things that's happening is the provider's perspective on this. And rather than judging people and seeing it as moral failure, we are seeing providers shift their mentality that this is another thing, and that patients are really in the community feeling that they're not going to be treated with stigma or, an approach that doesn't feel welcoming. And so that empowers them to bring their friends and family. We are now treating hepatitis C in our clinic. And I am getting a lot of referrals from the patients of their friends and family, because many of them are users or ex-users, and they tell them, we're cool. We're not going to get in their face. We're going to help them. And if they're, we call it lapsing. Once a patient has been engaged in treatment and had some success, well, the odds are at some point there's going to be a lapse. And we have a conversation about, okay, what happened? Let's break this down. How can we, thanks for coming to your clinic appointment. It's so good to see you. I'm so glad you're here. Let's just break this down. that for them is a conversation many of them have never had with a healthcare provider. It's more, you know, in the past, it's been more about don't do that, or I can't continue to see you, or I can't continue to treat you, or I can't continue to give you these medicines if you're going to do that. And it's not just us changing, you know, we're all changing. Healthcare is learning more about this. I just think we're a little ahead of the game.
Something else that's really exciting that we're doing in the, with as far as our role in the community is that we're having great conversations on transitions of care from our specialty providers. Our local inpatient treatment facility, Rimrock Foundation, has met with us, and they do a lot of work inpatient, and their physicians provide medication-assisted treatment as well. And there's not, in the past, not been a lot of transition of care. So they've met with us. We're developing discharge plans so that all that foundational work that they've set can be continued in our primary care clinic. So there's a transition. There's not a discontinuation of care and then things kind of unravel and then we got to do inpatient again. It's just a continuum of care. And it's really exciting to be able to work together with those specialty community partners to offer that in our community. And then also too, patients need primary care. So now they come in and again, that holistic approach.
I want to just comment briefly on one thing Sandy said about the continuum of care. And in addiction medicine, we talk about looking for the best type of treatment for the patient based on how severe their substance use disorder is and their prior experiences with treatment. And so primary care is a treatment of substance use disorder is not the best choice for everyone. And so really what we're teaching patients and other providers is to think about where this patient fits on the continuum of the treatments that are available and then trying to get them to that best treatment, okay? So for some people, for a lot of people, we can do it in primary care, but not everybody. And teasing that out is what Sandy and I do together. And sharing that with the patient and getting them to work through so they can participate in the shared decision-making. Very few people ever want to go inpatient for substance disorder treatment. I mean, think about the stigma, you know? So, but for many, I had one patient that really needed to go inpatient, and he did, and he's doing great now. But when I first told him he was failing outpatient treatment, I said he had to go inpatient. He goes, I don't want to go in there. There's a bunch of drug users in there. That was his own place. He wasn't really willing to or ready to accept that diagnosis. And so I just had to help him work through the stages of change until he realized, yeah, that's where he needed to be. So it's challenging, but that continuum of care and working with our community partners is huge to providing whatever the patient needs at that point in time.
So what does this substance use disorder work look like at Riverstone?
We are hoping to really just continue and maintain educating new providers as they come in, our residents each year as they come in, creating that just culture of this is another part of your clinic. This is another part of our treatment. I think that we could do better, even more collaboration with our community partners, having a little bit of our care manager, our goal this going into this next year is to have them see more patients and be involved collaboratively in their care, following up on them when they're getting medication management, things like that. I think that right now we're kind of in the maintenance phase of things, as you'd say. I'll let Dr. Mulville talk about some future projects that we're working on, or a big future project that we're working on.
So lots of new things. I'm meeting with the director of the emergency room at one of the hospitals in the first week of January, actually, to talk about transitions of care. Many patients that go to the emergency room are identified having a substance use disorder and are not admitted. And there's not a good transition of care. And so for many patients, they've come into the ER because they're sick from sequela of substance use disorder or you know, there's trauma, you know, they may have fallen or gotten in a fight. They may have gotten arrested and being brought in. But regardless, if those patients are using opioids, the better, more aggressive treatment programs in the United States identify that and start them on a medication at that point, if they're willing. And this is a big deal, but emergency room physicians have been some of the leaders in the community. Because if you could imagine how tragic it would be to see someone in an emergency room two or three times and then to find out that they have died. So, you know, transitioning, offering those services, I really, really, really want to get involved in that. Another big thing is transitioning out of criminal justice. So most criminal justice systems do not provide medication-assisted treatment, and patients, for the most part, are sober in criminal justice. And when they're released, that's a real danger point for reuse and death. So I would like to transition all those patients. I'd like to have the patients with opioid use disorder receive medication-assisted treatment in criminal justice and then transition out. I think it'll save lives. I think it will decrease reincarceration, and I think it will increase the ability to treat these patients for their substance use disorder. And lastly, I just recently took the boards to become board certified in addiction medicine. And we have the benefit of having another addiction medicine trained physician on our staff. And so we're looking at an addiction fellowship. We really, really, really need more people that are invested in the information, the best practices, evidence-based guidelines, to share this information with others and help others sort of change the philosophy that this is moral failure and look at how we can help people, how we can save lives, and how we can help people along the road to recovery.
So what advice would you give other health centers that are dealing with substance use disorders?
I would say start small and really get a good groundwork and foundation laid with that screening. I think that when you get good at that and you start with that, then everything flows from there. The other thing that I highly recommend for other health centers is to really network with your community partners. That's for a couple reasons. One, so that they know that what you're offering at your clinic, and two, so that we know what they're offering in their facilities. I'm talking specialty treatment centers, even our AA groups, our adult ed, the ERs, the psych centers, all of those that are providing services in the community, they can support and help lay a great foundation for your program so that we can really focus on overall wellness and have those tools that we need. So start small, get a good screening process, do a good workflow. Of course, consult with other community health centers. We learn to do this work by attending regional trainings and implementing things with our primary care association. So networking, I think, is the biggest tool that you can do to start, and start small.
I agree with everything Sandy said. I think the regional primary care organization meetings across the United States, your region, hot topic. The last meeting I went to in Denver, every single day there was a different talk on the subject. And most of the people that are highly interested are up at the speaker stand at the end of the talk, trading emails. Hey, from the last meeting, I've probably got 10 emails that people, hey, can I ask you questions? You know, things like that. In addition, training is everywhere right now. I mean, we are in the middle of a national crisis. The overdose deaths in the United States have gone up every year. This is really an unprecedented public health nightmare. And so the CDC, the federal government are responding, and they are making training available at very low cost in a variety of ways. So reach out to leaders in the field. They will point you in the right direction. The American Society of Addiction Medicine, the American Psychiatric Association, the CDC, SAMHSA, and your local primary care organization, all these places are just a click away, and they have webinar training. And it, the thing that happened with me is the first two trainings I did, two or three, it brought forth more questions than answers. You know, I was overwhelmed, but with both information and how to proceed. But there's a ton of people available now to network with and to support you along the voyage. And so it's just like diabetes. There's a skill set that you need to learn, and it takes some time and training, but it's not impossible. There's other people to help you. And once you learn this information and how to treat addiction, you can help a lot of people.
Well, thank you for sharing that advice with our Region 8 Health Centers. And thank you for joining us today for our second episode of this new Substance Use Disorder Best Practices podcast series.
Thank you so much, Rachel, for having us. And thank you for doing a focused podcast on this topic.
I'm really excited to hear some of the other podcasts and sharing in future opportunities to share our program.
Well, on that note, this and other episodes in our series are available for free download at www.champsonline.org on our events and trainings webpage in the CHAMPS Clinical Podcast section. And type transcriptions of each episode are also available. If you're interested in recording an interview for our series, please let us know by sending me an email at rachel@champsonline.org. Thanks for listening.